No, my whakarongo, my ki te au pai whenua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Duncan Smith.
And I'm Sally Murphy. It's great to be with you.
Today we meet a young man who raises and shows pigs.
A few weeks ago we heard about why pine trees were needed for New Zealand to meet its greenhouse gas emission targets. Today the role that indigenous trees can also play is discussed.
And we hear about a successful farmer selling milk directly from his farm to customers.
But first, to our look around the motu. Northland soils are extremely wet, so dairy farmers are continuing to stand cows off pastures where possible. A farm consultant says he hasn't seen damaged pastures when he's driving around, so farmers obviously are conscious of protecting soils. In Pukekohe, last week's cool fine weather was too good to last. This week it was changeable, with 17 millimetres of rain falling. Growers rushed to sow as much of their main crop onion seed as possible before the rain arrived. Greenhouse tomato growers are struggling to get enough labour, although it's improved a little with more working tourists coming in. New plant virus diseases have appeared and reduced yields, so it's a tough time.
Waikato, Bay of Plenty, King Country, Taranaki have all had a similar week weather-wise. Snappy cold with some frosts at the start, then a mix of sun and cloud. Daffodils are appearing in Waikato just as we've passed the shortest day. In King Country, ewe scanning results are mixed, from an exceptional 200-plus percentage to 10% back on last year's. In King Country, ewe scanning results are mixed, from an exceptional 200-plus percentage to 10% back on last year's. Bay of Plenty farmers were thrilled to see more sun. In the past 32 days, our farmer contact there had 480 millimetres of rain. His early scanned ewe results are similar to last year, but ones mated after mid-March are down about 10%. Mount Taranaki has a good covering of snow, but pasture growth in the province is still okay for winter.
Across the island to the east coast in Gisborne puddles up quickly after only 10 millimetres of rain. Hawke's Bay and Wairarapa also had some frosts earlier this week. Farmers are satisfied with stock generally in tip-top condition. In Wairarapa, there were good ewe scanning results, and the early lambers will be starting in a couple of weeks, with the main drop in September. After an awful start to June for Manawatū and Horowhenua, this past week has been drier and milder. Our Manawatū farm consultant contact says farmers are feeling pretty positive. Cows are in good condition and ewes are fat. Horowhenua pasture covers on dairy farms are a little lower than ideal. Feed gaps are being filled with palm kernel.
Across Cook Strait, apple pruning's in full swing in the Nelson Motueka region. The grower we talked to has a team of Kiwis and RSE workers from Tonga up the ladders. Pruning continues in Marlborough's vineyards too, and the weather's been okay, with just one day of rain this week. On farm, people are busy break-feeding sheep and cattle. A wet June in Canterbury is making a bit of mud when winter feeding stock. However, in between rain, there's been good drying winds, allowing some early spring-sown cereals to be planted. Farmers are fixing fences, planting trees and, on rainy days, repairing machinery. Farm input prices and availability is a real concern, with some inputs, such as fertiliser and diesel, doubling in price in the last 12 months.
A dairy farmer at Whatutoa on the west coast says heavy rain on Thursday night was not needed as the ground was already saturated. She says half her cows are away on a runoff, while the other half are on the home farm eating grass and crops. Central Otago farmers are shifting breaks and feeding out stock. Ice on the Idaburn Dam is about 40 millimetres thick, down from 70 earlier this week. A local farmer says for ice curling it needs to be at least 100 before he can hop on and throw the stone.
After some welcomed frosts last week, the rains returned, says our contact at Edendale in Southland. He's been doing maintenance work and making sure his staff take a holiday before calving and milking starts up in August. 1,000 of his cows are on a mixture of grass, baleage, kale, fodder beet and swedes. 600 are in a wintering shed and 400 are grazing off farm over winter.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
3 weeks ago, we ran an item talking about the role pine forests can play in sequestering carbon in New Zealand to help us meet our emissions targets by 2035 and then on to 2050. The communications manager for the Forest Owners Association, Don Carson, said he loved native trees for all sorts of reasons, but for locking up carbon in the necessary time frame, they don't compete. Take it forward 100 years and they do, but we don't have that long. Susan Murray with more.
Now, this really annoyed two retired Auckland University lecturers. Dr. Neil Mitchell taught ecology, conservation and environmental science for 40 years. Dr. John Craig was a professor of environmental management for decades. He now runs a conservation estate called Tahi on Northland's east coast near Whangarei. Country Life, in fact, visited him in 2015. Neil Mitchell says pines may sequester carbon quickly for the first 20 years, but 10 years later they're cut down and most of the carbon is dispersed and lost. Both men say give Indigenous forests a chance. The professor of the School of Forestry at Canterbury University, Ewan Mason, also wrote to Country Life saying there are a great variety of views on exotics versus natives, some well-informed, some based on fairy tales, and the truth is reasonably complicated. One of the problems seems to come from these things called lookup tables produced by MPI. They give a figure for how much carbon a pine tree or an Indigenous forest sequesters in any particular year. Professor Ewan Mason says from all the measurements he's seen so far, Indigenous forests on average haven't performed as well as the lookup tables indicate they should, while radiata pine has outperformed the table on average. He says one needs to ask why, what Indigenous species have been planted, where, and how have they been managed. So as he said, complicated. Now back to Neil Mitchell and John Craig. They've been working in Northland with planted native forests on retired pasture. In Northland, planting the appropriate species, they say there are really good growth rates and some natives are very dense and lock up a heap of carbon. What they've recorded in Northland, they say could be done elsewhere in New Zealand, although Neil admits results are likely to be lower than in Northland. But working with the current tables, they say, is flawed. John Craig picks up the discussion.
I think it's very sad that we're advocating planting exotics when it's not just climate change we should be dealing with. We've also got to deal with a biodiversity crisis, and natives are the best in both areas. We need to pursue both of them together, in my view.
And when you say it's flawed, Neil, when I do look at some of those tables, it does look as though pines do, especially in that 25 time frame, they are sequestering generally more carbon than the native counterparts?
Well, there's two parts to that. First of all, the MPI table is based on Manuka Kanaka, not forest, which is why it's much less. I mean, we would agree with their figure, no doubt. However, if you plant, like up at Tahi, where planting native forests from scratch, well, the rate they grow at is a northern broadleaf forest. You'd only need about two-thirds of the area of pines after 30 years because of the amount of carbon they sequester. It's very true of the northern species. The trees are so carbon-rich. Pines actually do not contain that much carbon compared to most of our native trees. And like a puriri, for example, it contains 2.5 times as much carbon for the same size. We've measured it, you know, and that the rate of growth of these forests is huge.
Does it still not come back just to that the time frame thing, that some of these targets we need to be getting by 2035, you know, such a short time away, that natives wouldn't be able to achieve some of that in the short term? I think maybe no one's arguing, are they, about perhaps the longer term?
The way I read what was said is the targets for 2035 be part of carbon zero by 2050. That's what, 30 years away. Well, I don't think even pines do that. By 2050, if you were to plant 380,000 hectares of pines now, yeah, they would do whatever that sum says. If you were to plant a much less area in native forests, you'd get the same result.
Susan, I think the issue about timeframes is that a pine is definitely faster for the first 20 years, but once you get to 20 years, then the natives overtake it. And the other problem with pines, of course, is we chop it down and then reactivate that carbon in a fairly short time frame, whereas with natives, it just stays there.
And keeps growing.
With the cut down trees, though, we are, say, wanting to put more of that into building and furniture, so it will lock some of that carbon up. So it will have sequestered some during its lifetime and then it will have remained locked up. Is that fair?
Well, it's fair. And if you look at the figures, we actually use a minority of pine as timber. There's an enormous amount used for paper and for sort of other products that require the wood to be chewed up and processed. If we could use 80% of the pine as timber, then we'd have a much better result than we do currently.
John, on your Tahi farming and conservation estate in Northland, what sort of figures and what are you seeing in a real-life example that can give us another way, maybe apart from pine trees?
Well, basically, I consider that we are carbon and biodiversity farmers, and currently you can't be paid well for either of those because the carbon that's stored is not currently acknowledged by government, and you saw the document I sent you, which has got the figures in it.
And looking at that table, John, yes, so in Northland you have got a hardwood podocarp. By year 22, you're saying it's actually sequestering more carbon than pine trees do.
Oh, and it, as you go forward, it sequesters more and more. It's much faster than the pine trees after that 22. But carbon should pay for the sort of work that happens here, and then the added benefit is biodiversity gains, where we have enormous numbers of rare birds especially have come in, and we have very high densities of birds. So we can do that everywhere if you use natives, whereas if you plant pines, there's not that many native birds that like living in pines.
Comment on the elephant in the room with pines is the seeds. Pine trees and other conifers, they seed from quite a young age, and their seeds disperse everywhere across the environment. You know, there's down here in Queenstown, for example, there's a massive wildling pine control program underway. And across great swathes of the countryside, wilding pines are like devouring the landscape. The more pines we plant, the more of this massive weed problem we have as well. But that's, as I say, that's the elephant in the room as well.
Is it a case too that with the ETS that natives are disadvantaged against exotics in terms of how their carbon is calculated?
Yes, they're absolutely disadvantaged in terms of how much carbon is acknowledged, and they're also more expensive to start off with. And we have a program that basically for pines, the government will pay forward on carbon. So you get an extra gain, which is taken off later on. If we did the same for natives, we could equalise the problem of more expensive to plant in the first place.
Again, I suppose it just comes back to the time frame thing. Do we still need pines to help do a little bit of the heavy lifting in these earlier days? Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either.
The tables are not readily available. That's the problem. Like, I've sent it to you. I've given it to the minister. It's gone to MPI. It's gone to DOC, etc. But it's not acknowledged. So at the moment, you're still paid as if it's just Manuka and Kanaka that's grown a higher latitude. So nothing as fast as up here, even for Manuka and Kanaka.
With the MPI information, for pines, they carefully, gave it region by region. Well, okay, you could do it for natives. There's vast databases of tree measurements being done over decades. You know, for native, again, they've just got this one column. Well, I had a look at what I think is the original work that came from. The original work looked at it regionally.
Why do you think they're not being looked at or used? Why have they been ignored, John?
So I think it's a political issue, and hopefully it'll get solved, and the sooner the better.
And will we need to? Some of the issue that has got the rural community up in arms is the fact that we are putting pine trees in, we're taking land out of sheep and beef farming. Would, in order to meet some of these greenhouse gas emission reductions, would we still need to be taking quite a lot of land out of sheep and beef? And, but you'd be saying, but it could go into natives rather than pines, although one would have to say too that pines do have an export value, don't they? You would still say we would have to remove some sheep and beef country in order to reach some of these targets.
How about converting land that's just coming out of pine rotation back into natives?
Also, I think farmers are pretty astute in terms of knowing how to earn money, and there are large areas of hill country which is pretty marginal pasture, and it could earn a lot more from carbon if it was planted in natives, and if the carbon content was recognised. So we just have to use real figures instead of the ones that we have at the moment, which are wrong, and are the problem.
The point keeps needs to be making. Carbon is carbon. And to pretend that pine carbon is worth more than native carbon is complete nonsense.
And just going back, you know, to that question I asked earlier, John, what would your reply be about do we still need to take more land out of, say, sheep and beef and put it into natives in order to reach these targets?
Well, you do, and as Neil pointed out very early on, you need less natives than you need pines, so you'd have to take less farmland out of production if you went to natives, as distinct from going with pines.
Looking, another thing I thought was interesting was the pest control. If you can get rid of pests, if we could control pests, what impact would that have on native forests and their ability to sequester more carbon? How significant and important is pest control?
I remain shocked that this hasn't actually been addressed. Can I just try to paint a little sound picture for you? Imagine you're a tree, your arms outstretched. You can only feed in the day. Your fingers, you know, use your fingers to catch anything that goes past and consume it. Now, at night, you stop. However, at night, possum come out and they like to have a nibble on your fingertips. And so, you know, gradually, your ability to catch food diminishes. And so you actually stop growing. Oh, and by the way, during the day, a goat or some deer comes along. That's a nibble at your skin on your legs. And so you can take up less water from the ground. That's actually what's happening in our native forests. And so, of course, they're less able gradually over several years to be able to sequester carbon.
The goats and the deer also take out all the associated shrubs and small trees which are storing carbon as well.
I've got some working figures. You know, a possum will probably eat 1%. Well, it'll cause a 1% reduction in one possum in a hectare. We've got 10 possum a hectare, which is not uncommon. It's 10% of the sequestration that year has gone. Of course, it's cumulative. It's 10% on whatever's left the next year. And then you've got everything else going on at ground level.
Maybe we should put all our effort into pest control and not even planting more native things. We could be just improving the native forests that we've got struggling along at the moment.
The Predator-Free 2050 program, it seems to be unacknowledged that this is going to achieve massive more carbon sequestration in the native forests. Should they be, that program be getting the carbon credits from all this wonderful work they're doing?
Yep. And let's reward farmers that grow natives. and care for them with pest control.
Yeah, if you link it all together, pest control then becomes, for example, a tax deductible expense against the income.
Yep, it would. Yep.
So what, run that past me again?
Well, if you're farming carbon, then you can claim the expenses against that, which would include pest control. And at the moment, we don't really treat carbon in native forests as a business. Why can't we sell carbon? After all, the current government plan is we're going to buy carbon from other countries. Why can't we be the people who sell it to other countries? Because there's an enormous number of them who have no ability to achieve what we can achieve.
And sell it to them off our native forests.
Well, look, there's about 10 million hectares of native forest in New Zealand. Much of it, I assume, is under the stewardship of Department of Conservation. Much of it is infested with pests. Now, step one, you actually control all these pests and predators that are on government-owned land. The government should actually look to their own backyard first and fix the problems that they actually own. So, you know, you fix that one, you solve a whole lot of both biodiversity and carbon sequestration problems. But then because the forests have been so damaged, there's another whole industry, if you like, in there, of then making sure species that have become lost from local areas or whatever actually become re-established. And so we get back once more the flourishing forests we should have. How's that for a legacy for a politician?
I'd like to, can I modify that version slightly? I think I heard from Neil that the government should be doing pest control. Well, for me, the first thing they've got to do is put a real price on carbon of native trees, and then it will pay the government to do pest control because they can earn more from their trees, but it also allows everyone else in New Zealand society to earn the real price of having natives and looking after them.
I said the benefits are huge.
And the other thing that you can quote is that Tahi is an example of where we actually believe so much in this that we're doing it now, and hoping the government's going to catch up.
That was John Craig ending the discussion. We also heard from Neil Mitchell, and they were talking to Susan.
Hi, it's Jess here from Dreamview Creamery. We sell milk in reusable glass bottles. You're listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
While some teenage boys get stuck into computer games after school, you're more likely to find Fletcher Keane out in a paddock or a pig pen on his parents' 25-acre lifestyle block at Springsdon in Canterbury. He raises farm animals and shows some of them at local A&P shows. His mum Nicole tells Cosmo how it all started.
We moved from the North Island, we lived in Taupo, and then we came down and got a lifestyle block, so that's really probably where his interest came. He got two ducks for Christmas that Santa delivered him, and that probably started the animals. So he loves going to shows, so the white hens out there, he bought them specifically for the shows, but then the shows have been cancelled, so they haven't actually gone to the show. The ducks behind us, he's hatched them from eggs that we got from Leeston, so he could take them to the show as well. So he's always thinking about something new to take.
And you did pretty well with those ducks, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess I have done pretty well. Yeah, but now I've drifted away from my ducks, but I've got pretty good amount of ribbons for my age.
How long have you been showing for?
I think it's coming up 6 years now. So.
And how old are you?
14.
Do you enjoy the showing aspect of having animals?
Yeah, all of it pretty much, yeah. You meet a lot of people and nice lots of people and, yeah, they want to know your stories and all these guys are generally older and they're generally keen to help younger fellas.
Now there are two piglet boars in front of us. What will be the first show you hope to go to with these?
Ellesmere A&P show, which is Leeston, held in Leeston. A few pigs there normally, and then a few months or a month later into Canterbury Park, in the November show. New Zealand Agriculture Show, which is much bigger but more fun yesterday. More bigger.
What type of pigs are they?
Hampshire Landrace Cross. They'll be about 25 weeks sort of thing now.
What makes these two piglets so special? What caught your eye?
I think I might have been away on a rugby trip when Mum picked them up, but yeah, I didn't really get to choose this time, but we've always pretty much used this guy apart from the first year, so I guess we'll keep going back. They taste good, yeah.
Will it take a long time to get them ready to go into a show?
Yes and no, like, they don't have to be real friendly, but friendly helps. You really just gotta feed them well and look after them well. As long as it's got a warm bed, they're growing well. And then the day before you take them in, gives them a scrub. I do it in the trailer, so they, before I take them in. And then we, to get all the dirt and stuff off them, and then when we get in there on the show day, I put a bit of baby oil and, yeah, makes their muscles stick out and everything.
How many pigs have you owned?
So the first year we had two saddlebacks, and they were called Hamilton and Crispy Bacon. And then the next year we had Tractor, Donald Trump and Tresemme. And then last year we had Dr. Ashley Bloomfield. Yeah. And then this year you've got Piglet and probably Bacon.
They're quite muscly.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what you're looking for, just good tucker.
Do they end up in the freezer?
So after the November show, we book in the home kill guy and then, yeah, comes in. Normally while I'm at school, so I don't really have to see anything, but, yeah.
Is that quite hard for you? Because I guess you must get quite close to them. I mean, they're hanging around us now like they're keen for a bit of a scratch.
Yes and no, but, yeah, I try not to get too friendly, but... When we first started, the pigs were like my brothers, pretty much. They followed me around everywhere, and I could take them on leads, but I was only young. I knew what was happening with them, but, yeah, ever since that, I just feed them in the morning and night, and they've got an automatic water trough, so, yeah, and make sure they've got warm bed. And then I've got a Suffolk stud, and just run a few Moggies sheep. Suffolk, there's some down there. Oh, I've got my Moggies here. I've got my rams here.
Now we've walked over to a paddock where you have your Suffolk rams.
Yeah, I've got about 10 Suffolk rams, but I've sold a few as well, so just the keepers really now.
Where do you sell the rams?
A few local guys, and then I've got a guy in Omaru, Mount Stauger, who takes 6 off me every year, so that's good.
Nicole, you must be pleased to see Fletcher learning about money through these animals.
Yes, it is good, and it's something that he likes to do, the animals. So, like, he's got 3 siblings who are not interested in animals, so it's nice to see him out here enjoying and able to make money out of it. He's the richest out of them all because they can't be bothered. So, you know, his work has paid off.
Have you invested quite a bit?
With the Suffolk stud, I've invested heaps, but, yeah, I had to work hard for that. But now I'm just trying to stay on top of everything.
And what happens to the wool that comes off your sheep?
The shearer's taking it, but the price isn't that well, so he probably just burns it, if I'm honest. But the only good wool price at the moment is Merino and a few other breeds, but the rest is $1 or 50 cents, not high enough for anything good.
Nicole, there's quite a lot to think about, isn't there, with all these animals?
Yes, there is. We have assisted him because we have to register the sheep. So everything, all those sheep have got a tag in their ear, and then they have to be registered on the sheep association. So we do have to keep records, and then records of what they've produced and if they're any good. So he does have that in the spreadsheet now, just to keep track of everybody.
Yeah.
And especially at winter when there's not a lot of grass, we have to be feeding out. So you can see that there's hay on the ground, and Fletcher after this will be going out and feeding lucerne to the sheep to supplement them in the colder weather. And I look forward to lambing season, generally, being the maternity ward and midwife.
How many lambs are you expecting this spring?
Well, approximately 50. So we've had two lamb already. So we had.
Oh, yes, there's a lamb over there in the shed.
Yeah, so we've got shed. A pet one. Our daughter's pet lamb, Sugar's, had twins, and then there's another single there. And then these ladies are due any time type of thing. So we're quite early, but we've got the Suffolk spread out and the Moggies going off first. And we do have a teaser ram, so that helps. So he's out for 2 weeks, teasers, and then we put in the stud ram. So they will all lamb then, hopefully within 2 weeks.
Nicole Keane, ending that story from Springston. Cosmo was also chatting with her teenage son, Fletcher, who breeds sheep and shows pigs.
In our next story, we're heading to Wairinga. It's in North Waikato, tucked between Te Kowhata and Maramarua. But first stop, a high school dining room.
This is a story about milk. Students at Hamilton St Paul's Collegiate have had the chance to push a button and fill a glass with fresh, cold, non-homogenised cow's milk delivered each morning from a farm just 50 kilometres away. The school's been trialling Happy Cow Milk, milk that's processed on-farm using a new system engineered so individual farmers can sell safe milk direct to consumers. There are rules, though. The cows have to be farmed the Happy Cow way, with a particular focus on being green and kind. The milk the St Paul's students have been tucking into was produced on Chris Falconer's farm.
So this is the magic box where the milk comes to, just out of a stainless steel line that comes off our normal milking equipment.
So you've got your great big vat here with the Synlay sticker on it.
Yes, we do.
So you supply Synlay.
So we supply Synlay, and we've got, I call it the Happy Cow tap down over there, which just diverts the milk into a different direction. So most of it goes into this big tank, but what we want to process, and when we want to process it, we just turn the tap and we fill the kegs over here for the Happy Cow milk processing unit.
And they do look like beer kegs?
They do look like beer kegs. They're actually a keg within a keg. So on the outside of them, there's a water jacket. That's how we pasteurise the milk. So hot water gets pumped around the outside of the keg within a keg. And once it's been held at pasteurising temperature for 2 minutes, it switches to cold water and then starts to cool the milk down again. But yes, they just look like big beer kegs.
So tell me about the Happy Cow model.
In essence, it's delivering milk direct to consumers from a farm. It just accounts for some of the attributes that people are looking for in milk these days. So they want less environmental footprint, they want more animal welfare or higher animal welfare standards, and they just want that direct connection so they feel like they can support farmers doing the things that they like to see happening on farm.
Chris says the next step is to supply cafes and other schools. He says a trial at St Paul's went so well, milk deliveries will be a permanent arrangement.
You take one of these kegs, you put it in the back of the ute, and we unload it there, and we put it on a little set of wheels, and then we just push it out into the serving area, and away you go. You press the button, milk comes out.
So the kids would just fill up their cups with milk straight out of the keg?
Yeah, it's got three buttons on it. And each of the buttons does a different thing. So one button dispenses 150 mils, which is about the size of one of those typical cafeteria glasses that you see. Or you can press and hold a button. So kids are coming up with a bowl of cereal, just putting it directly underneath the tap and pressing and holding the button so that the milk would come out. And when they were ready, they just let it go and that was it. And the other one dispenses half a litre. So You could also come up with a carafe and fill your carafe and take it back to the table.
And what feedback did you get? Did they tell you it tasted creamier than other milk?
Well, it definitely tastes creamier than other milk. I think typically, you know, the dark blue top is about 3 to 3.5% fat and about a bit under 3% protein. But our milk goes at more like sort of 5 to 5.5% fat and 4 to 4.5% protein. So it's noticeably denser is what I would say. Also, I think people comment on sort of the texture being sort of a richer texture, but it's also got sort of a sweeter, vanilla-y kind of flavour to it, which I think is quite appealing.
Happy Cow is the brainchild of a guy called Glenn Herod in the South Island,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, so Glenn, he first started it as a farmer, as a processor, as a distributor, as a marketer, and I think one of the issues he ran into is that he was trying to do too many things, and that just the act of transferring milk to the processing and then having to bottle it and do all those sorts of things, it was just too much. So he kind of thought there had to be a better way, and the better way was just making it easier for existing farmers to process on farm. So existing farmers are actually good at farming, and we know what we're doing, we're quite efficient at that. And so it was just a matter of connecting us to a system that enabled us to be efficient processors and distributors as well. So that's effectively what he's done.
How many of you are doing this?
We are the only ones. So we're the trial farm. So we get to make all the mistakes for everyone else. So you can thank me later for that if you like. Yeah, we're the first trial farm, but we think there's plenty of legs in it for other farmers. So we'll iron all the bugs out for you, but it's actually been it's been remarkably easy.
Should we just go and stand in the sun?
Sure. You want to come and stand in the sun, Goose?
I read where one of the things that Happy Cow farmers do is that they leave the calves on their mums.
Yes, so that's another thing that we're trialling. It's a cool idea and people want to see it in action, but it's just we've just got to make sure that we're able to make it stick on farm. And yeah, that's what we're doing.
So the calf gets first dibs and you get what's left, is that right?
Yeah, we're sharing with the calves. and to be fair, what we've found is that the calves don't just drink off their own mothers. They're equal opportunity drinkers, and if a cow will stand there long enough, trust me, they will. So it's not so much that they drink just off their own mother. There seems to be a little bit of a community spirit going on, and some cows, they love it. They actually seek the calves out. Sometimes the dams just do not want to feed their calves. Mismothering does occur. So we've found a whole bunch of things that we weren't necessarily expecting happen.
Watching calf behaviour with their mums is something that's probably quite new for dairy farmers.
It is, and I think, you know, beef farmers will and beef breeders will see it in action, but I don't think they see it in action as regularly as we do, you know, because we have so much interaction with the animals, because on a daily basis we've got this process of bringing them in to milk them, and obviously the calves come with them as well. So we get to observe that quite a bit. I think the thing to stress is that we watch them very closely, and if things aren't going the right way for the calf, we're not afraid to bring it inside and rear it in a conventional way.
What else do you have to do differently now that you're supplying Happy Cow milk?
Well, nothing in particular. So, you know, it's not like I've had to go and stop doing a whole bunch of things on farm, because we don't feed palm kernel, we don't use artificial fertilisers, we don't do a whole bunch of cropping. And so there's just a whole range of elements to management that we were already doing. And so for us it was quite a straightforward sort of thing for us to take on.
You talked about your environmental footprint. I noticed that you've got some fabulous plantings down there. Is that something that you put a lot of effort into on this farm?
It is, yeah. I want to work in an environment that I'm happy being in. So we've planted probably close to 15,000 native trees on the farm. To date, we've got a policy of only planting native trees. And we try and do it in a way that sort of sets it up to be habitat, so we get some ecosystem benefit out of it as well.
How many cows do you have?
We have about 320 cows, 330 cows, and we split calve. So we calve roughly half of them in the spring and half of them in the autumn. So we produce milk all year round. But we only milk our cows once a day. So I know, unlike most farmers, that I do 365 milkings in a year, but for others it could be, you know, 600 plus milkings a year. I think that's one of the things people often say is, oh, you have to milk every day of the year. And I say, yeah, but it's 365 milkings. I know exactly what that is. It's not too stressful.
And what percentage of your milk do you think is going to head the happy cow way?
Well, at the moment, we're talking hundreds of litres, small hundreds of litres. And one of the barriers to supplying your own milk directly to customers is that at different times of the year, we produce different amounts of milk. And that's actually a really hard thing to manage. We're dealing with a product with a shelf life, and we're dealing with markets. So our approach is that we'll feel our way up to an amount of milk that we can manage in our existing system. And then we have a processing partner, Synlay, that comes and picks up the rest of our milk. And that means I don't have to manage some of those peaks and troughs. You know, they're at their big processes and they're used to dealing with those things. It's very difficult for an individual farmer to do that. So the answer is, I don't know, maybe 20-30% of our milk.
Yeah, why did you do it? The easiest thing would have been to just keep on putting that milk into the vat, the big vat.
Yes, it would be the easy thing to do, but we do a whole bunch of things that aren't necessarily considered to be conventional. I've been really conscious for a while of what the market is interested in terms of the attributes of the products it wants to consume. And as a farmer, I don't think there's anything more satisfying than being in direct contact with consumers. So that's really satisfying. And how do you do that? Well, you've actually got to do something about it yourself, because no one's going to do it for you. You have to get amongst it yourself. So it's a bit of a difference, because mostly as farmers we're price takers, and we sit inside our farm gate and a truck comes and picks up whatever it is we have to sell, and out it goes.
What do you think the price point will be per litre of milk for the Happy Cow milk?
We want it to be accessible, so we don't necessarily want to make it, you know, we feel like it's a premium product, but because we don't have a whole bunch of people sitting between us and the market, that we can get it out there for not much more than what people would normally pay for milk. And that's important to us. If we differentiate ourselves and then we're only for a small portion of the community, then what does that say about us and our relationship with our community?
$3-4 a litre?
No less than that. No. I mean, you can buy those high end milks in the supermarket for $4 a litre, but no, we're not going to be anywhere near that. No. So much less.
And that will be more than you're getting for your bulk milk.
Yeah, it'll be more. Yep. It'll be considerably more. But then again, I don't have to own a milk tanker, and I don't have to own a powder dryer, and I don't have an office. I've got a desk in my bedroom, and I don't have a marketing budget, and I don't have a whole bunch of those things that sit between a producer and the market. They just don't exist.
Are you excited about it?
I'm excited about all sorts of things. You know, selling out through Happy Cow is almost, for me, it feels like an outcome of all of the other stuff that we do. And the fact that we like to farm with our values at the front end rather than sort of bolt them on or add them in when we can afford them. You know, we don't use any dairy we don't rear our own dairy replacements, so we have no bobby calves to deal with. So we just buy other people's empty cows and nurture them and get them back in calf, and so they become part of our story as well. So we recycle other people's cows that, for varying reasons, fall out of their system.
Obviously, they didn't get in calf, so there might be some underlying issue. So what's your success rate of getting them back into milk?
Pretty good. We're sort of 85 to 90%. But people have effectively abandoned them to their fate, and so We don't have to pay a lot for them for a start, because most people they're rejected, and we get a lot of young cows that are just underweight, if nothing else, you know. And so we sort of rehabilitate them by milking them once a day and sort of throwing some of the common metrics out the window. We're not interested in the BW and PW, the indexes of cows. I'm interested in offering a cow an opportunity to exist in her own right, and that's important to us as well. So that's kind of sort of one of the values that we hold, is that in what's been really satisfying about having calves with cows is that actually it's not been about us managing them, it's just about offering them choice, and hey presto, it's easy. As soon as we're not trying to press them into our system and we let them do what they want to do, it gets easy all of a sudden. So we only have beef cross calves born on the farm. We aren't in a position where we've got an animal that the industry doesn't want for whatever reason.
How much milk do you think the calves drink?
Well, I know that calves can drink up to sort of 10 or 12 litres a day if they want. The science behind it, I would say, isn't really precise. The answer is we don't know. This is all just an experiment for us. We'll find out as time goes what the impact on production is, but the calves come out really good. and it's just nice and easy for us, and it's just really quite satisfying to see them, really. So the answer is, I don't know.
You said you didn't buy any palm kernel. If things get a bit lean on the farm, you haven't got a lot of grass, what do you use to supplement?
So we buy byproducts, and just the normal byproducts that you can get from the brewing industry or from the milling industry. And, you know, there's plenty of non-food grade materials out there. I'm not necessarily opposed to the use of palm kernel, but plenty of people tell me that they are. And I guess my message to them is I'm listening, and I don't need to have an argument with anyone about it. I just listen and respond. And if the response is, you don't like it, we won't use it. I'm not going to have an argument about it. Poppy! Poppy! Come on. Come on, Poppy. Poppy! Come on, you're usually not shy. What's going on? That's Mary over there. Mary was born with bilateral palsy, and under the normal course of events, she wouldn't be with us now, but we hand-reared her for 3 or 4 weeks until she could stand up. And as you can see, she's fine and dandy now, but she'll always be a little bit... She's got to stay with us. We can't put her out in challenging paddocks because she's still prone to falling down from time to time, but she's quite happy here.
Hey, Poppy.
Hello, Poppy.
And she's a Jersey.
She's a Jersey, so we wouldn't normally have a dairy-type animal on the farm because we use beef bulls, but we had a neighbour's bull who was quite interested in our cows one day, so he hopped over the fence and helped himself. So Poppy was the result of that little tryst. Mm. Oh, here comes Mary. So you see how she... Look at her head, the way she moves.
Right, she's got a bit of a wobble on.
She's got a wobble on. Hello, Mary. Mary's a little bit more circumspect, but... Hello. She actually was raised and grew up with Gertie the pig, so she was good friends with Gertie. They used to snooze together in the sun after having their milk in the morning. Mary... I think there's a lot to be said for having animals, lots of different kinds of animals around you. We set up all of these small paddocks around the house specifically so we could have direct contact with animals as we pleased. And if we had, you know, circumstances like Mary here, then we could fit them in as well. We have to take responsibility for every animal that's born on this farm. And that's just part of it.
Chris Falconer, happy cow milk producer with his two happy cows. His next project is to retire and plant out another 50 hectares of his land. He says he's taking it out of production because it's the right thing to do. Chris farms beside the Whangamereno River and says it's a taonga. And Happy Cow raised $500,000 through crowdfunding so its founder, Glenn Hurd, could develop the milk processing and distribution system. If you want to learn more about it, we'll put the link on our webpage.
Next week, a high country farmer blends hemp fibre and merino wool to make a range of clothing.
And ever heard of a grass burger? We're in the paddock finding out about the potential of new technology to harvest pasture in a way that extracts the proteins, enabling them to be developed into human digestible ingredients.
Well, that's it from us. Wrap up warmly and have a great weekend. Bye now.
Cheerio.